Hello and welcome to the Fitness Simplified podcast. I'm your host, Kim Schlag, and I am thrilled today to welcome my guest, Dr. Nisha Patel. Dr. Patel specializes in clinical lipidology, culinary medicine, and obesity medicine. Her passion is helping people improve their cardiometabolic health, so she's really looking at preventing and treating those chronic diseases of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, and obesity. Today, we take a deep dive with Dr. Patel into the obesity medications that we're seeing. So if you've heard of Wegovy, Mounjaro, and Ozempic, that's what we're talking about today. What are these drugs? How do they work? How do you know if you're a good candidate for them? What are the pros? What are the cons? That's what we're talking about today. Now, before we jump into the episode, I want to remind you that right now you can grab for free my Menopause Nutrition and Exercise Quick Start Guide. In this guide, you're going to find the nutrition and exercise considerations that are going to be most impactful in helping you support optimal health and empowered aging if you're a woman in your 40s, 50s, or beyond. We also cover weight loss considerations in menopause. You can grab that at the link here. You'll find in the show notes. It's at kimschlagfitness.com. You will find it there. All right, on with the show. Nisha, thanks so much for joining me here on the Fitness Simplified podcast. Thrilled to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk about obesity medicine as a field and just really my passion for this field, because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I think we could set the record straight with some facts.
Absolutely. For sure. You know, I find it really interesting that you have this whole like cluster of specialties. So obesity medicine, clinical lipidology, and culinary medicine. Can you kind of briefly explain those and then tell us about your path to this set of specialties and how they work together?
Yeah. So my path was a little bit abnormal or kind of unexpected, I should say. So, you know, when I left training, when I left residency, I actually thought I wanted to be an oncologist. And if you're not familiar with that term, that's a cancer doctor, that's basically like very different from where I landed. And I was like, I'll just go out into practice. I'll work for a year or two, and then I'll apply to fellowship and go back and become an oncologist. But it was so interesting. I was like, I think it was like maybe my first or second year probably of just being out in practice. And I had learned about the field of obesity medicine, and I decided, well, you know what, let me just attend a conference. I ended up attending like a virtual conference, and then I just fell in love with the field. I mean, it was just so fascinating. You know, during all of my training, no one's ever talked about obesity being a disease. In fact, we've never really even talked about taking care of patients with obesity. I had never heard of the field of obesity medicine until I was well into practice. And so I was just like shocked that there's this whole fascinating field. This was like the first time I was hearing about it. And one of the really interesting parts of obesity as a disease, there's a strong neural component, neurohormonal component. And I have a background in neuroscience. That was my undergrad. And so I was really able to like pull that that degree and that information back into my practice. And I just really, really fell in love. And I then learned about the field of culinary medicine through obesity medicine. I think there was like a talk about culinary medicine. And the way you can think about this is, enhancing kind of the nutrition education and knowledge that we have right now with culinary literacy. I think that's a very important piece that's missing. You know, we can tell our patients like, hey, you need to do X, Y, and Z when they're in the clinic with us. But then if they can't translate that information into action in their own kitchens, it's really, really difficult. And I think that one part of culinary medicine that's so important is that it celebrates the joy of, really eating like health promoting tasty foods and really teaching people how to flavor and build flavor in their meals, because that's so important. If you're not going to really enjoy what you're eating and it feels like a punishment, then you're less likely to do it. So I
love to do it for very long.
Do it for very long. Exactly. It's like, it's like the all or none kind of like, yes, I'm going to eat broccoli and some sort of lean protein. And like
plain chicken and plain broccoli. That's the new plan. It's not going to stick.
Exactly. And then I also learned about kind of just through this field, I should say, about clinical lipidology. And what I really am passionate about, if I had to put one kind of specialty on it, which doesn't exist, but there's been a push to make this a specialty, is cardiometabolic medicine. And this is a, you know, this is a caring for patients with cardiometabolic diseases, which include obesity, heart disease, diabetes, fatty liver disease, high blood pressure, and more. And a lot of this care happens in silos within the medical system. You know, the cardiologist taking care of heart disease, endocrinologist taking care of diabetes. And, you know, we really are trying to, you know, really bring all of these disease processes together. They share common kind of pathways of development. And we know that if a patient has obesity, then treating the underlying obesity tends to make a lot of these diseases better, or improve them, I should say. And not every, you know, patient that has diabetes has obesity, but it is intimately linked. And so really trying to like give patients comprehensive care across the spectrum of all of these diseases, like a one-stop shop. But it's not just like the doctor that's involved. It's really like an exercise physiologist, a behavioral health specialist. Dietitian is a huge part of our, you know, this kind of care model that doesn't exactly exist across the board yet, but there are some centers that are implementing it. So that's my hope and my my dream for the future. But this that's how I got here.
Yeah. Cardiometabolic health, all those diseases you mentioned, those are all the big killers, right? Those are the things like the top killers of people today, right? Like those are the big ones.
We know that, like, for instance, by 2030, about 50% of the US population is projected to have obesity. By around that same time frame, you know, one in five individuals will have diabetes, which is, you know, increased from what it is currently. Like, currently, as it stands, if you look at the US population, the adult population specifically, I'm not talking about children here, I don't treat children. We're looking at about 50% of US adults have either prediabetes or type 2 diabetes. So that's, you know, a substantial number. And I think of, you know, prediabetes and type 2 diabetes as a disease on the same spectrum. You know, we don't say, oh, you just have a little prediabetes, it'll be okay, see me like in a year. You know, we're like, no, we're starting to see some signs that we need to really work on lifestyle changes using medications as needed. And so, yeah, I mean, we're going to see worsening rates of these diseases. Heart disease, for instance, you know, with all the advent of all the new technology, CABG, stenting, statins, we've seen a decrease in overall heart disease. But we're starting to kind of see an uptick because we think it's in parallel with the rising rates of obesity. And so, you know, it's important that we really first educate our patients that, hey, these diseases are very intimately linked and there's things that you can actually do in your own homes that can help reduce the risk of these diseases and their complications if you have them. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, medical management is an adjunct to those lifestyle changes.
Well, I'm super interested to see what happens with this trend of obesity and in this prediction of numbers with the advent of these anti-obesity medications, which are, you know, just the hot topic in the news, in the fitness industry, like everyone's talking about these. And I think you're a great person to have this discussion with considering what your specialties are here. So Wegovy, Ozempic, Mounjaro, talk to us about these. Let's start with kind of an overview of what are they and how do they work?
Yeah, so Wegovy and Ozempic are essentially the same medication. So I'll talk first about those. So they were, Ozempic, also known as semaglutide, which is the same thing that Wegovy is, was first approved for the treatment of type 2 diabetes back in 2017. But in clinical trials, the patients not only had improvements in their diabetes, there was also some weight reduction associated with using semaglutide. And so, you know, if you want to have a medication go through and be approved for a new indication, like obesity, you have to go through another set of clinical trials in the United States. And so, you know, there were a whole other set of clinical trials that happened for the approval of semaglutide under the brand name Wegovy in 2021 for the treatment of the chronic disease of obesity.
But it's the exact same medication.
It's the exact same medication, which is why
people are getting really confused. It's three words for the same thing.
Yes, exactly. It's like semaglutide is Ozempic and is Wegovy. But because it's approved under two different indications, like Ozempic is a brand name for type 2 diabetes, Wegovy is a brand name for obesity, people, of course, associate Ozempic as a diabetes drug, but it's like, well, it's actually the same medication as Wegovy. And I think where some of that confusion came through is that When Wegovy was approved in 2021, it was the most efficacious medication that we've had on the market. We've had other medications to treat obesity. There have been oral medications, and we do have one other GLP-1 receptor agonist, liraglutide, under the brand name Saxenda. But this was, Wegovy was the most efficacious medication that we've really encountered on average to treat obesity. And so the popularity was, there's a lot of popularity surrounding it. And unfortunately, the pharmaceutical company had some manufacturing issues. They weren't able to keep up with the supply. And so what ended up happening is that all of these patients that had started Wegovy for treatment of their obesity, they couldn't find Wegovy essentially anymore. And so we ended up using Ozempic off-label because it's the same medication. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of led to a lot of confusion because it's like, you see the words Ozempic in the news a lot, and technically it's Wegovy that's approved for obesity, but again, same drug. And so people were like, well, why are we using a diabetes drug for weight loss? And you're like, wait, it's the same medication, I promise. Like,
and using a medication off-label isn't unheard of.
Like, it's not illegal. We do that. You know, we have a discussion with our patients if it's something that, you know, we are using off-label. It's not illegal. It's not illegal to do that. And so, you know, if the insurance and there's coverage for it and the patient can't afford to take it off-label, then we use it off-label because, you know, not every like indication is going to have support and funding to go through another set of clinical trials to get that medication approved. And it's just the unfortunate truth. But so there was a lot of buzz about this diabetes drug being used for weight loss and people with diabetes couldn't get it. And we're like, well, a lot of people with diabetes also have concurrent obesity and treating their underlying obesity treats their diabetes or helps their diabetes too, right? There's independent effects of like, it's not just weight loss that these GLP-1 receptor agonists induce. There's other effects. We have receptors all over our body. We know that they're cardioprotective in individuals with diabetes. And so, you know, there's a whole host of effects, I should say. So that was kind of the bug around the whole Ozempic and then Wegovy. Now Wegovy's back. The stocks are better, but I would say we get signals that, you know, they're like going to be future shortages of the lower doses, which is frustrating for patients and physicians alike. And so then came the approval of Mounjaro, which is the generic name is tirzepatide. And this is the first medication and it's in its own class. We don't have any other medications like this. And this is a dual GLP-1 receptor agonist and GIP receptor agonist. And it's a very interesting medication. It is only currently approved for type 2 diabetes, but we do expect after it's gone through its own set of clinical trials for obesity that it should hopefully get obesity indication approval this year. But same kind of thing that happened with semaglutide with Ozempic, you know, patients had not only an improvement in their diabetes, there was this kind of really robust on average weight reduction in the trials. And so currently can only be covered by insurance companies if they cover it for type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. Insurance companies are cracking down on the off-label use of medications to treat obesity. It's, I feel, not entirely fair, only because they don't do that for any other drugs that are used off label. They just do it for the drugs. I mean, I'm not aware of
them. Surprising considering the fact of, you know, the number of diseases that can come along with obesity that then insurance is going to pay for a person to have treated. It seems like why not kind of cut it off at the source, right? Like, why would insurance companies not be for that?
Yeah.
Save them money in the future? It feels like it would.
You know, that's so funny that you mentioned that. I was having this discussion with a colleague of mine. She's an endocrinologist and obesity medicine trainer. And we were talking and it's like they don't have the foresight to see the downstream effects or downstream potential savings. You know, obesity is viewed as, I'm not even entirely sure if in their eyes they view it as a disease. I mean, I'm making big generalizations here and I don't want to like call it, I'm not sure that really like what they base their criteria off FDA indications first and foremost. So whatever the FDA has approved the medication for, that's what the insurance companies base their criteria off of if they approve it. Now there's many plans that doesn't matter what I do, how much I beg, how many appeal letters I write. They're like, it's a plan exclusion. Sorry. So So in those cases, I'm like, but it's a disease. You're like, you know, you're basically saying that we don't treat this disease. Like, we're not going to approve treatment for this disease. Cause they'll send me back letters and be like, it's an anorexic agent, or it's a, like, we don't approve weight loss agents. And we're like, wait, weight loss is the outcome of treating the disease. And so, you know, I don't think that these, some of these companies, I should say, I feel like they're not looking downstream. I think they're not looking ahead. I think they're not connecting the dots. It's kind of like what society did with like the Ozempic diabetes and obesity. They're like, it's a diabetes drug, but it's like, well, 50% of the US population is projected to have obesity. 1 in 5 individuals will have diabetes. Obesity and diabetes are intimately linked. You know, we can't, if patients have both of those diseases, like, we can't separate the two out and be like, well, we're just going to treat the diabetes, you know? Right. And so I just don't think they have the foresight, or they're really just focused on kind of the now and like, how can we maximize our profits now, or kind of save money now? Cause the medications are expensive. Like, that is like probably the number one biggest barrier right now, is that they're expensive and insurance does not consistently cover them.
Yeah. That's like a big con as far as these medications are concerned right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is hopefully something that with time, you know, that will be, the cost will be reduced.
We hope so. Fingers crossed, you know, fingers crossed that they will, because I just, the way they are right now, I mean, they're averaging like cash price, depending on the pharmacy you go to, like $1,300 to $1,600 a month. And these are chronic medications. I think that's really important for people to understand, meaning that they're meant to be prescribed long-term. And so I think insurance companies are like, well, this is a really big price tag for, you know, treating this disease, and they're just not willing to do it.
Yeah. Okay. So you brought up another, what a lot of people are saying is a con of these medications. A lot of kind of pushback about the idea, like, well, if you start this medication, you're going to have to stay on it long-term. What is your response to kind of that piece of the discussion?
Yeah, I think that it's important to go back and understand that obesity is a chronic disease, like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, many more. And that, you know, if you were to stop a high blood pressure medication abruptly, or if you were to stop taking it, I mean, we see changes in people's blood pressures within days. You know, it's like, oh, did you take your blood pressure medicine this morning? And they're like, oh, I forgot, because I was running around. So it's the same concept here. It's no different than, you know, stopping a diet, or stop, like, if you stop, you know, eating healthfully and exercising, you know, you could, and if you're trying to do that intentionally to, you know, lose weight, like, you could regain the weight, right? And so I tell patients, you know, this is a really important part of my counseling. The first time I meet them, especially if we're talking about starting medications, is that, look, these are meant to be long-term medications. They're not something that we prescribe for 3, 4, 6 months, and then we hope that, you know, once you're at your goal weight, we just take you off and that you won't gain the weight back. We know that the majority of individuals in clinical trials, when they're taken off of the medication, they do rebound to the weight. Really, they don't really tend to overshoot their weight from their baseline, but they do rebound to their baseline. And so, yes, these are, you know, these are long-term medications, and it's no different than stopping a diet. Like, if somebody were to do the keto diet, like, I'm sure a lot of my patients have done the keto diet. Yeah. And the minute they stop it, the weight just comes right back on. It's the same concept here. If you stop doing something that's working for the weight loss, then you're definitely going to be weight loss of long-term weight maintenance. You're definitely at risk of having weight rebound. And that's something that, you know, we're not hiding from patients. We're not shy about telling our patients. It's important to counsel. I think sometimes that, you know, patients might go to other types of med spas or clinics and they may not get the appropriate counseling. And so there's like this unrealistic expectation that, like, okay, I'll just lose the weight, stop the medication, and then I'll just stay at that new weight. And that's really not how that works.
Yeah. This whole med spa thing is so surprising to me. So I follow this influencer. He's this dad influencer, and like, he's always showing stuff about his kids and how he keeps house, and he's just kind of interesting. Well, he started going to this med spa and got Mounjaro, and this was months ago, and I was like, what is he doing? And he's lost a lot of weight, and now he has a code for people to go and use this. And like, every time I look at it, I'm like, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like, if I was a person who wanted to get a medication, I wouldn't use an influencer's code and go to a spa. I would want to go to my doctor's office.
Yeah. So there are places out there, med spas, other kind of, I'm going to use clinics in air quotations, that are compounding, you know, semaglutide and tirzepatide and selling it in vials, which, by the way, for all of these medications, like both semaglutide and tirzepatide, under all of their brand names, they're in pen form. You're not going to get, like, if you're getting a vial with syringes to drop the medication, that's a compounded version.
Tell people what that means. What does compounded?
Yeah. So it basically means that it was made from scratch, essentially, like by a pharmacy. And oftentimes it's compounded with other agents. Like it could be vitamins, it could be other like medications that you may not be aware of. And really, we cannot vouch for the safety or efficacy of any of these compounding medications. I do not prescribe compounding medications to my patients. I do not, recommend the use of compounding medications. First and foremost, the pharmaceutical companies that have created these drugs own the patents. So it's very peculiar and like interesting to me, like how do these compounding pharmacies or these places know exactly what quote unquote ingredients are in there to make the compounded medication? I don't know. States are starting to crack down because, you know, there's been like safety issues with certain like compounding pharmacies. They're not up to code as far as like sanitation standards. Like there was like, can't remember exactly what drug it was. It was compounded, but there was like an outbreak of an infectious disease because like the patients were infecting themselves with that compounded medication that was like contaminated with bacteria.
Oh my goodness. So
it's not, you know, those are not FDA approved medications. Can't vouch for their safety or efficacy. I'm just like really shocked as to how these places know how to make the medication is under patent. And so I know it's being sold at like much cheaper rates. Like, I think it's just like, I don't even know. I've seen so many different prices flowing around. And sadly, I've seen healthcare professionals also selling compounded medications.
Interesting.
And it's, I should preface and say, it's not, you know, we compound medications. Like there are certain medications that get compounded, you know, creams, syrups for other, you know, indications to use. So it's not that compounding itself is like illegal or we don't do it. It's just that, you know, with the popularity of these medications, they're first being, you know, compounded and sold as a quick fix. Like, I don't know if this is under like who's the provider or physician that's supervising this. I don't know. And I don't know what their follow-up is or how they're like monitoring these individuals, but I do not recommend compounded medications. The Obesity Medicine Association came out with a statement on compounded peptides. And they also don't recommend using those for, we just can't, I don't know. Like, I essentially don't know what's in them. You know, it's just, I don't know.
And that, yeah. So you mentioned the idea of following up. You don't know who's following up and overseeing it. What are some of, when you're counseling with patients who are using this medication, what are the lifestyle factors that you're working on them with or having them work with someone else about? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I always tell patients that when I think about the treatment of obesity, comprehensive treatment, there's kind of like six things that I think about, six kind of buckets of treatment that all work together. So, you know, I always talk about our nutrition and physical activity, like that has to be talked about. And I'll get into that a little bit more. Stress management and sleep are also very important for the treatment of obesity. And then we talk about medications. And then for certain individuals, bariatric surgery might be appropriate, you know, either now or down the line in the future. But when it comes to lifestyle, I mean, nutrition really is the crux. You know, we really want to emphasize a health promoting dietary pattern that's personalized to the individual and their families and ultimately results in a calorie deficit. And we talk about how this could be different dietary patterns. There's no one size fits all. It's not, you know, it's not keto or this or that. It's really trying to, I really try to emphasize a healthful and health promoting dietary pattern, you know, filled with lots of the foods that we grew up knowing that were, you know, health promoting. Like we know fruits and veggies are health promoting. We're just not eating enough of those. And that's where my culinary medicine background comes in, because we talk about different techniques to actually flavor food. And my hope is one day that I'll be able to do more cooking classes or group classes with my patients and actually like do demos and in like a conference room with them. I'm working on that. But, you know, that's, it's really just talking to them about like, hey, it's a personalized approach. I do talk about creating, you know, balanced meals. I think it's important that, especially for weight loss and weight management, that our patients are eating enough lean protein. You know, we have like the RDA for protein, which is 0.8 grams per kilogram, which is enough to prevent deficiency. But when it comes to weight management, the requirements are higher, and especially if they're elderly and more frail, the requirements are higher. And so we want to make sure that they're eating enough protein, lean protein spread throughout the day across their meals, and eating lots of vegetables and fruits and, you know, whole grains and health promoting fats. But, you know, eating a lot of these foods, or kind of eating bigger volumes of these foods, they tend to be lower in calorie. And so you're kind of already creating a calorie deficit without thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I do think it's also important for patients, you know, some sort of self-monitoring, being aware of, you know, kind of what they're eating throughout the day. I don't ask my patients to calorie count. First off, that's like, it could be really stressful for somebody. And like, that's not what we're trying to do here. We're not trying to add stress, to a person's life. And so, but I do think it's really helpful for patients to understand what they're eating throughout the day. So I do ask them to track, you know, the types of foods that they're eating, especially if it's in response to like a stressful situation. So stress plays a huge role, in driving eating behaviors outside of, you know, hunger. And so I stress eat. Like if you put Oreos in front of me at a really busy hospital shift, because I also work in the hospital too, those Oreos are going to be gone, you know? So it's really just to bring awareness to that eating occasion, bring awareness to the fact that it's underlying stress that's driving this versus like my hunger. Cause I always say honor your hunger. We're not here to like make anybody, unnecessarily feel hungry or starve. Like that's not what this is about, but we eat for more than just hunger. And so trying to understand what those cues are is really important. So I call it my food and mood log to help patients. So yeah, for awareness. So we, you know, we work, and I do refer to registered dietitians. I have a group of dietitians that I work with, because it's impossible to do everything myself. And I have a lot longer for visits. Like I have an hour for, you know, seeing my new patients, but even then, you know, that hour flies by.
Yeah.
There's a lot to say there.
An hour is fantastic.
Yeah. It's sometimes if I don't have, I feel like I could talk for hours and hours, but, and the patients are like very grateful for that time too, but like, I wish I had more time is what I'm trying to say, but, cause there's just so much to say. But you know, when it comes to nutrition, I definitely introduce like what, you know, what a health promoting dietary pattern is, and really kind of understand like where they're starting at. You know, some of my patients are like, well, I'm already doing X, Y, and Z, and I need help with X, Y, and Z. And so we're like, okay, well, let's work on that. And some of my patients are like, this is the first time that I've ever tried, you know, to, make healthy eating habits. Like, where do you suggest that I start? And so we look at what they're doing right now, and then really make personalized, like, and personalize and realistic goals. I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. You know, physical activity, incredibly important for overall general health, overall cardiometabolic health. I think that one thing that people may not realize, or patients are kind of often surprised to hear, is that if you change nothing about your lifestyle, like physical activity or increasing physical activity doesn't really tend to result in robust weight loss in and of itself. But it's exceedingly important for weight maintenance. And we know based on the National Weight Control Registry that individuals that have been able to maintain weight loss over the long term, they're exercising about an hour a day. So we're really trying to work up to that by the time patients are at their healthy weight, and now they need to maintain that weight loss. So it's not that I don't say don't exercise, it's that we're like working on incrementally, and we kind of focus on the nutrition up front, especially if a patient's like, there's so much that I'm feeling really overwhelmed, like there's a lot to do. I'm like, start, just walk as much as you can walk. And I think the one thing I will say from the get-go with patients that I'm like, buy weights, buy resistance bands. When you lose weight, you're not just losing, you know, adiposity or fat mass is what we call it. You're also losing lean body mass. We want to try to kind of mitigate that rate of loss. Especially again, if they're elderly, they have other chronic medical conditions. I do talk to them about this. I tell them, I mean, I don't particularly enjoy weightlifting, but I do it, you know, I do it. But that is one thing that I talked to them about. Like, you know what, if you're watching some TV, like, you know, you can lift some weights, or if you're in between meetings, put those resistance bands at your desk, and then have like some sort of little exercise app pulled up, would it be Apple Fitness? I have no loyalty to any of these brands or anything that I'm mentioning, but you know, just some sort of fitness app where you could do a quick 5-10 minute resistance band exercise, and you could do that several times throughout the day. It doesn't have to all be done like in one sitting. So that is something that I talked to them about. And
that can definitely help with one of the other criticisms that I've heard about these medications, which is there's a higher rate of muscle loss with these medications. There was one doctor who was on a really major news program talking about some crazy statistic, which didn't seem right anyway. But what do you have to say to that as far as muscle loss with Wegovy, Ozempic, Mounjaro?
Yeah, it's no, I mean, I don't think it's any more robust than, you know, what we would expect with weight loss in general. Of course, we have to be mindful of individuals that are at higher risk for muscle loss, that and definitely my elderly patients or patients that have other like heart failure or they have like liver disease. I see those patients pretty frequently and we're like, must get enough protein at every meal. You need to do this resistance exercise. And I think that's where body composition testing helps too, right? To really understand like at baseline and as weight loss occurs, like what's the change? And so I would say if there's people out there that are experiencing the amount of weight, the amount of muscle mass loss that was quoted in that news segment, that's very concerning. And there should definitely be work up for other causes. Like, I don't think any, you know, we don't want our patients to get more frail. Like I definitely from the very beginning emphasized that this is why resistance training is incredibly important. And it's no different. Like if you're doing some sort of diet and you're losing weight, you're also losing muscle mass. Mm-hmm. And resistance training is also important in those situations too. And eating enough.
So it sounds like it comes back to the same things for losing weight in any losing fat in any situation, that we want to prioritize eating enough protein and we want to do resistance training, and that can help, limit the amount of muscle mass you're going to lose when you're losing weight.
Wait, exactly. And I think, you know, maybe that's something that I get concerned about when I see patients on these like compounds. And like, I'm like, is anyone talking to them about like these very important factors that need to be taken into consideration? Like, are they counseling them on adequate nutrition and physical activity and resistance training? And I'm not sure. And maybe it's in those scenarios that individuals are losing, you know, excess muscle mass because they're not aware of these other changes that they should try to implement to, you know, prevent excess muscle mass loss.
In general, who do you say is a good candidate for these types of medications?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if first when it comes, I will say insurance coverage really kind of drives who gets to be a good candidate. I hate to say it that way but it's just the reality. Like a lot of my patients are quote unquote, you know, good candidates for taking these medications, but if their insurance doesn't cover it, and I mean, $1,300 to $1,600 a month is not affordable for the majority of people. That's crazy expensive. And so, you know, I do my best and we try to get it approved, but, you know, there's the FDA criteria that we talked about. So the FDA criteria is that anyone with, and it's BMI based, and I unfortunately can't get around this. Nobody can get around this. This is what the FDA says. And so we have to go by this criteria, but it's anyone with a BMI of 30 or greater, or 27 and greater with a comorbidity that's associated with obesity. So that could be diabetes, fatty liver disease, obstructive sleep apnea, heart disease, or more. So those are the FDA criteria. That's what the insurance uses. Unfortunately, a lot of it comes down to, especially for the newer medications, the GLP-1 receptor agonists like Wegovy, it comes down to insurance coverage. And so, you know, we want to make sure that and it's not just that, right? When we're talking to our patients, we're getting their medical history. There's a couple of like, well, I guess there's one kind of in particular FDA contraindication, although we really haven't seen that signal in humans, is the incidence of a specific type of cancer called medullary thyroid cancer, commonly seen in individuals with multiple endocrine neoplasia 2 syndrome. I have not seen either one of those in my patients. None of my patients have those conditions or have a history or family history of those conditions, but that is an FDA contraindication. So we have to abide by it. So that person is not a good candidate. if they've ever had any intolerance to some of the other GLP-1 receptor agonists. So it's important to note, especially if they've had, you know, these medications, first off, have been around since 2005. There's a number of them approved for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. So if they have diabetes and they didn't tolerate one in the past, something to consider and keep in mind when you're starting another one, or starting like Ozempic, for instance, if they have diabetes. To, you know, monitor them closely, or if they've had, you know, if they've tried Ozempic before and it just didn't work out, then, you know, probably don't want to use that medication again. Interestingly, some of my patients that haven't tolerated Ozempic for their diabetes, they, I switched them to Mounjaro and they are tolerating it better.
Okay.
So yeah, so it is a good option. You know, making sure that I think also that the patient is ready to really go on this journey with you is really, really important. And if they're not quite there yet, if they're not mentally quite there yet, let's say they have a lot going on, there's a lot of stressors in their lives, they're, you know, are exhibiting patterns of disordered eating, like then I really switch my conversation to like weight neutral, healthy habits. And so maybe it's not the right time to start a medication, and we don't want to cause, you know, any unnecessary harm or unintentional harm. And so, you know, in those patients, that medications may not be appropriate. But I would say with the newer class of medications, like they are probably the safest medications that we can use in our sicker patient population. So I see a very kind of different patient population, maybe than the average obesity medicine doctor sees. I see patients that are, they have liver failure, they have heart failure, they have, and these are pretty advanced, like not advanced. It's not just like a touch of heart failure or a little bit of like fatty liver disease. So I'm seeing pretty sick patients, and the other medications are not really the best medication out there for these patients. I can't really use them safely. And so these are the safer agents to use. So I would say you can apply them to a broader population, but the problem is insurance coverage. That's like at the end of the day, that is the biggest bane of our existence.
Yeah.
For both patients and physicians, I wish that I just really wish it was different.
Yeah. What is your prediction for the future of these drugs? Like right now, super pricey, insurance coverage isn't there. Do you see in the future expanding the use of these drugs for overweight, not just obesity? Do you see that in the future?
I think the more competition maybe that's created hopefully by some of these other pharmaceutical companies, and because there's a lot of different drugs in the pipeline. There's like, you know, there's even been a signal that they're the oral version of semaglutide. They've reformulated to be a higher dose and longer acting, has produced like pretty robust weight loss in clinical trials so far. It's going to take a couple of years before that actually gets approved. But my hope is that with competition or newer agents on the market, that the price point does improve, I hope. As far as, you know, will the FDA change its indication for these medications for insurance companies to get on board with new criteria? I'm not sure. You know, right now, technically speaking, a BMI of 27 is considered in the pre-obesity or overweight category, but you have to have that one comorbidity. We also know, I mean, this is something I alluded to earlier, that BMI is not the end all be all of health. Like there are plenty of individuals, quote unquote, with a normal BMI that have metabolic diseases. I mean, if you look at the South Asian population, that's my background. We tend to get heart disease earlier in life, diabetes early in life, and at lower BMIs. It's not so much about, you know, the BMI, it's like, where are you storing the excess adiposity? And we tend to store it like in our midsection. So, you know, again, BMI is not the end all be all of health. I'd be curious to know if the FDA would change their criteria to help kind of like in the with pre-diabetes, like for pre-obesity, would they change the criteria to 25 and above with the comorbidity? That's to be determined, but I hope that the drugs will get cheaper. And I'm really excited about this oral option, although I think like it's going to be a little bit of time before it gets approved. Cause some of my patients are like, shots, even if it's once a week, I don't care if it doesn't hurt. I'm not doing it.
Yeah. And so oral could be good for this. It's very exciting to see like what might happen. This seems like a big step forward in the treatment of obesity. So I'm excited to see what comes next. So let's kind of turn our attention to another subject that's very related. I would be remiss in not talking about this, considering that your Instagram handle is Dr. Plantel, which I thought was so funny. I actually thought that was your name.
Oh, people do think that
for a while. And then I realized, I'm like, wait, no, it says her name is Patel. I'm like, oh, that's funny. Because you're always talking about the idea, you know, just the benefits of a plant forward lifestyle. So give us some of your favorite suggestions for eating more plants for people who don't like to, or right now don't have a ton of time to cook.
Yeah. So a lot of my patients will, not a lot, but like several of my patients come in, they're like, doc, I just don't like vegetables. And I'm like, okay, let's dig further. And so, you know, we really start going into this conversation about, well, what vegetables do you like? How do you prepare those vegetables? Are they steamed? Did you boil them? Because I personally don't find steamed or boiled vegetables very appealing. Like I just actually this morning before I got on the phone with you, I made peanut noodles and it was like, I just sauteed like a bunch of zucchini and bell pepper and it smelled like so good with garlic. But if you told me to like boil that zucchini, I would be like,
yeah, that sounds terrible.
Yeah. So one of the things I tell patients is that, especially when they tell me I don't like vegetables, it's like, well, the ones that you like, let's start to eat more of them. Let's just start eating more of those. And, you know, if they're like, well, I only like this handful, but I really want to try this. Like, what do you suggest? Like, if they want to, you know, if they have broccoli and now they're like, well, I'll try cauliflower. And I'm like, well, you can try roasting it. You could try sauteing it. And like, again, that comes down to like having comfort in the kitchen, which not, you know, everyone does. Like if you asked me 10 years ago to like saute the food that I just made this morning, I would be like, what's saute? You know?
Yeah.
It's taken me some time. So maybe that, and if they have like certain pieces of kitchen equipment, like oftentimes I find that patients have the kitchen equipment available, but it's just sitting on a shelf and they haven't used it. Like they have an air fryer or they have like an Instant Pot, but they're like, yeah, I don't really use it. And I'm like, are you serious? I use those things every day. And again, it's a comfort level. Like, you know, they're like, well, I don't really know what to make in it. And we'll talk about like, so I have like recipe packets that I'll give patients, like just to give them inspiration, not telling them what to eat. But I'm like, hey, you have this air fryer. You can make this like, you know, salmon in it. You like enjoy salmon. And then you could like, you know, roast vegetables in it. And you said you wanted to try cauliflower. So it's really like this personalized approach, kind of understanding where they're at. Some of my patients are very skilled cooks, but they're like, yeah, I just want to get like more vegetables on my plate. And we again, talk about the ones that they like, how they're prepared. And then I think it's really shifting kind of like the balance of their plate too, right? If they have like a smaller like serving of vegetables, I'll be like, well, why don't you double that serving? So just double that serving. You don't have to change anything else. Just do that. And they're like, okay, I'll double that serving. And maybe you'll have like a smaller portion if they're eating like some sort of refined grain or something like that with their meals, they'll do a little smaller portion of that and then, double their vegetables and then have some sort of lean protein, for instance. And I say, it doesn't have to be separated out in the plane. Like you can mix it all together. You can make a grain bowl, you can make some sort of protein bowl, whatever you want to do. But I think it's starting with those small changes and really first understanding where patients are at and then starting with those small changes and giving them ideas. Like I will honestly be on like some sort of online grocery store in the room with them, like with my screen turned so that they can see. And just giving them suggestions, they're like, well, I really like this, but like, I don't know, it just seems like it takes too long to prepare. Mm-hmm. And so we'll be like, well, have you tried this product or like that product? And like, I pay a lot of attention at the grocery stores. I pay attention to prices. I go to all sorts of different grocery stores, like quote unquote bargain grocery stores to like, you know, Costco's. And so I'm mm-hmm. really paying attention like to what's available out there. And I have like a handout that I'm working on for my patients where it's like easy to incorporate grocery items or easy ways to incorporate like, you know, fruits and vegetables and to give them, because I think having those practical suggestions, like again, not telling them that they should buy this, but it has to be, you know, has to work with their budget and their family lives and, mm-hmm. and just their overall like, you know, hustle and bustle from their day to day. But like giving them ideas, I think is helpful because I think we kind of get stuck. And I do too, right? We all get stuck in the rut of like, what are we cooking for dinner tonight? Or like, what should we make this week?
I hate that question.
Yeah. And I always, you know, we try to work on like having those like 5 to 10 recipes in your back pocket. Like I'm not making gourmet chef meals like every day, but I'm also not the person that can eat the same meal like 2 days in a row. I'm just not like, I mean, more than 2 days in a row, like it's not appetizing to me. And so I definitely have a system that I've worked on, but that's not going to work for everyone. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is like helpful for patients to kind of eat the same types of foods where they're not, because it takes the think work out, or, you know, like the stress of like having to meal plan out of it. Just trying to figure out what works for patients is so important.
Yeah. And I find helping people kind of figure out where they fall on that spectrum of how much variety do they like? And how much easier will their life be if they're repeating food, and kind of finding the sweet spot for that person? Because some people are like, I don't really need a lot of variety and I need meat. And then that's a perfect person. Like, let's have you eating the same lunch every day for a week before we even consider it. And then other people are like, well, you just said, they're like, that sounds terrible, right? And so then we need to kind of adjust and be like, okay, can you make the same foods every Monday and the same foods every Tuesday? Like, we can really find that sweet spot of variety versus ease and kind of tailor it to each individual person. I love your conversation around like finding like what are the good products out there that are going to work for a person's budget. That's super important. And their flavor palette. Look, I was a grown woman. I was 43 before I started eating vegetables, which I know sounds nuts, especially since I'm a health and fitness coach. But yeah, I'm 52 now. And I did not eat vegetables regularly till I was 43 because I always said, like, I just don't like vegetables. And Same. So when I decided at 43, like, it's time to try and be a grown up here and figure out a way to eat vegetables, I did what you said. And I started with like, what do I technically like? And I had liked cream spinach. I didn't really eat it very much, but I'm like, maybe I could just start with something with spinach. And so I started sauteing spinach in chicken broth with garlic, and I would eat that. And then I was like, okay, I seem to like garlic. What else could I put garlic on? And so then I started doing like zucchini noodle things on my Foreman grill with the zucchini noodles and that garlic paste, and like just kind of like grilling that up. I'm like, okay, I like that. And so little by little, I was adding like one more vegetable on. And then I was like, I wonder if there's a way I could like salad, because that seems easy and I need it easy. I'm like, how could I like salad? And I'm like, well, I could find a really good dressing that I like. So I hunted around till I found a dressing I liked. And then I looked at the different textures and I'm like, I definitely don't like kale. And so it took some hunting around to figure out. And now like there are very few vegetables I don't eat, which is another thing I did. I gave myself permission to have certain vegetables I just wasn't going to eat because I didn't like them. I do not eat green beans to this day. And I do not eat peas to this day, but there's like 40 other vegetables now that are in my rotation that I like, because there's no specific vegetable that you have to eat. You just need to find a way to eat some vegetables. But really kind of looking at it as an experiment, as like, okay, I'm going to see like, what can I try, and giving yourself like time and space to figure it out. And you'll be shocked that someday you can be a person who actually regularly eats vegetables. And maybe you can even say like, I'm a person who likes vegetables. That was a big moment in my life.
No, that's huge. And that's very similar, because I grew up vegetarian and I did not like vegetables. And people would be like, well, you're vegetarian. Like, how do you not like vegetables? And I was like, I just don't. And I remember in training, I like distinctly have these memories of like going to the grocery store and like looking around at the vegetables and the fruits. And I'm like, I wish I knew what to do with these. And then I would get like carrots. Carrots were kind of like the only thing that I liked. So I'd just like grab my bag of carrots and then like run off to the cereal aisle and eat cereal. Because, you know, when you're a resident, you're like so busy. You're like, I'm gonna eat cereal for dinner.
Things
have definitely drastically changed, but like, it's like you said, it's incremental small changes and trying to figure out like what works for you. And I don't like every vegetable. It's like, it's probably gonna be blasphemy that I say this out loud, but like, I don't like the texture of like avocado slices, but I'll eat avocado in a sauce. I know people are like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, I just don't like the texture of avocado slices, but like, I'll eat it in a sauce, or like I'll eat guacamole. So like, if that's like the way that I enjoy it, cool. Like, I'll just eat it that way. And that's like also telling patients, like, you don't have to eat it the way that like you think you're supposed to, or like you grew up thinking, if you don't enjoy it, like there's other ways to like prepare these vegetables and fruits for you to eat. Yeah.
I think it's also important for people to realize that eating things in like cans and frozen vegetables is also, because, you know, there's a lot of people online who make content around the idea that it has to be fresh and it has to be organic and it has to be from the farm down the street, right? That's the only kind of vegetables that is good. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I say any form of vegetable that you can, or fruit that you can afford and reasonably implement into your lifestyle is really important. Of course, if you're doing like canned or frozen, you want to try to find the, you know, varieties that there's no added ingredients because, you know, the sauces come with lots of salt. They could have excess calories from that incorporated into the sauce. So really just trying to find those varieties that have like lower salt, no added ingredients if possible. But if you look at the statistics on like the average consumption of fruits and vegetables in the United States per individual, it's dismal. Like it's really, really bad. And I don't care if it's fresh or frozen. I don't care if it's organic or not organic. You know, we just want to get more fruits and veggies on your plate. And so whatever that looks like for you, that's what we need to do. Because it's better than not eating them at all. You know, we know that you can have improved health outcomes with eating more fruits and veggies, especially when they're replacing other sources of maybe calorie dense foods in your day-to-day eating. My husband and I recently started eating, cotton candy grapes, like kind of for dessert. Yeah. 'Cause they're really, yeah, those are so good. And I've only been able to find them like at specific times or specific places. So, but we've just been having fruit after dinner. I went to the farmer's market and got a bunch of different oranges and cherries and grapes, and we'll just kind of have a fruit salad. And that's really, really satisfying for us. Cause you still get the sweetness from the fruit. And then of course it's fruit, it's a whole food. So it's, got its own other sets of benefits. And so whatever that looks like, I'm not elitist about food. People are struggling to make ends meet. Prices of food in the grocery store have gone up, and there's a real problem with food insecurity in our country. You know, one in 10 individuals experiences food insecurity, especially households with younger children and single parents. And so we really want to make sure that we're not unintentionally creating an elitist mentality around food or making people feel bad about their food choices, because we don't know what people's circumstances are. So it's really, really important that I get kind of on my horse when I hear, I see the, you must only eat organic, or you must only eat this quote unquote clean food, which I don't like that term at all, clean eating. Cause I think it just creates a lot of negative connotations around food and can really create guilt for people. So yeah, I just think that whatever you can afford and reasonably get on your plate is what you should do.
Absolutely. And look, I mean, eating frozen broccoli, it was picked at the peak of freshness.
Yeah, exactly.
That bag, so it's actually very nutritious. They're such great tools that we have in our toolbox. I mean, it takes me no time at all to throw a bag of frozen broccoli into the microwave and I have a great vegetable. There's not chopping, there's not the cooking procedure that could take place otherwise. So I think they're great tools. So the very last question I'm going to ask you, I like to ask all of my guests what they currently like to do to move their bodies.
Yeah. So I've been walking a lot. I love outdoor walks in the morning, first thing in the morning. So I'll just go out with my headphones and maybe I'll listen to a podcast. Maybe some of you are listening to this podcast while walking. It's just nice. I live in the city. I live in San Francisco. And so, the weather here can be a little bit weird. It's been raining a lot, but any day that it's not raining or it's sunny outside, I'll definitely get out for a walk. And I also lift weights. I think that's really important.
I like how you said that you don't even like doing it, but you do it anyway.
I do it anyway. You know, I tell myself that it's I tell myself the 5-minute rule, especially on the days when I'm I really don't want to do this. If I can do it for 5 minutes, and after 5 minutes, if I don't feel like doing it anymore, I won't do it. But if after 5 minutes, I feel like I should keep going, then I'll keep going. And almost invariably, I'll keep going.
Yeah. So, I love that. Nice. It's a great strategy that literally, I just need to get started. I'll do something for 5 minutes. I can do that.
And then my husband and I, we like to go on hikes. And I have a stationary bike that I like to use. And so I'll do that. So I'm on my feet quite a bit at work as well. So I just try to tell patients sit less, move more is what I try to emphasize. And, we do have a lot of individuals that have sedentary desk jobs. So it's getting a standing desk or standing up for a few minutes every hour, especially if you're watching TV, any amount of activity is better than nothing. And so that's what I really try to emphasize. But getting structured physical activity is obviously very great. And resistance training, we've talked about how important that is.
I love all of that. I love all of that. Thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation with me today. Tell everyone where they can find you.
Yes. So I am active on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Dr. Plantel. That's DrPlantel. And I would love to have y'all, you know, peruse around and interact with me. Let me know if you decide to come and follow along so that I could welcome you with open arms to the community. Cause I really am trying to create just a very open, an accepting community where, you know, trying to help patients make healthy lifestyle changes or individuals like get inspired to make healthy lifestyle changes and combating misinformation. I think there's been a lot of misinformation in the health and wellness space, especially over the last couple of years. And
yeah,
there's just not enough of our voices out there that are out, unfortunately able to kind of override some of the more louder voices. But I think trying and continuing to try is really important.
Yeah, you're right. I love social media. I think there's just great power in it, but you know, it's also the Wild West and trying to combat all the misinformation out there. It sometimes feels really heavy because there's just
so exhausting. Exhausting. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to change this person's mind. But you know, I have people that message me. I've even had patients come to me from social media. So for me, it's overall been a very like positive experience. And I think it's just a really great way to interact with individuals that I normally would have never interacted with. And meeting like-minded individuals like you, Kim. So
I love that. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has
been fantastic. No problem. This is great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Fitness Simplified podcast. I hope you found it motivational, inspirational, educational, organizational. If you did find value in this episode today, it would mean a great deal to me if you would leave a rating and review on whatever podcasting platform you are listening to this episode on. It really does help to get this podcast in front of other people. Thanks so much for being here.